Welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is native memory issues for WebSphere Application Server. Today's presenter is Kevin Gregorenko. Kevin is a software engineer on the WebSphere Application Server SWAT team, which provides worldwide on-site and remote supplemental product defect support, particularly in client customer support situations. He focuses on problem determination for WebSphere Application Server and related stack products and operating systems, including the IBM and Oracle JVMs, AIX, Linux, Solaris, Windows, ZOS, HP UX, and i5 OS. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Kevin. You may begin.
Thanks, David. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining. Slide 2, please. So this will go over Linux native memory problem determination with a focus on WebSphere Application Server. And we'll go through kind of the high-level concepts of native memory, particular to Linux as well, how to detect native memory leaks, how to monitor native memory, how to isolate and avoid native memory, native out-of-memories, and then finally how to analyze native memory usage. Now, a few things I want to note at the top here. First is that I am not a Linux kernel developer, so all of the things that I'm talking about here I hope are correct, but I did the best that I could to research the issues. Most of it just comes from customer experiences and debugging dumps in GDB and things like that. The other thing is that this presentation contains a lot of content, and I won't go through every slide in detail. I included the extra detail just for comprehensiveness, and I will basically just try to cover the highlights of each slide. And then if you have any questions, you can email me at the email address on the first slide. Slide 3, please. So what are we talking about? Native memory issues, whether they're out of memory or simply sizing or related issues, are notoriously difficult. I'd say they're, along with performance, the most difficult class of problems. And one of the reasons is that they cause a lot of different symptoms, such as crashes, instability, high CPU, and they're not often completely obvious that it's caused by native memory leak or other issue. And often isolation, to isolate the problem or to avoid the problem in various ways that I'll cover, may be easier than actually analyzing and figuring out the problem, and I'll give reasons why that is. And then, as I mentioned, we'll talk about the various types of analysis. The bad news first is that the built-in Linux native memory leak detection tools are probably the worst of all modern operating systems. That's particularly because the built-in tracing in glibc doesn't give stack traces. It also has a huge overhead, which I'll describe later. AIX, ZOS, Solaris, and Windows all have a quite good built-in leak detection that tracks leaked memory and gives full stacks. The good news is that Linux provides a lot of different ways to understand native memory. Some may consider that bad news because it requires kind of a deeper understanding of everything and all the different options and different ways of looking at things and then integrating all of that and coming to a conclusion. Nevertheless, that's what I'm going to cover, and hopefully that will help in any issues you encounter. And finally, this is an educational presentation for customers. It doesn't represent specific advice or recommendations from IBM. Some of the things that I cover in this presentation, IBM support may not be able to analyze or may not request, and if you upload it, it may not be looked at. So this is really just for everyone's education. Slide 4, please. So what is native memory? Native memory is essentially the playground that the process has to deal with memory. So usually a process such as Java will require memory to actually perform operations for the customer web pages or whatever is being returned. And the native memory is built up of many things, including the actual code of Java and any other third-party libraries, such as dynamically loaded libraries, the actual data inside those binaries, any dynamically allocated memory. This tends to be the majority of the virtual memory, of the native memory, and such as some may be familiar with the concepts of malloc and mmap, but I'll cover those on the next few slides, the actual thread memory and stacks. The native memory, the theoretical native memory, is limited by many things, including the hardware architecture, whether it's 32-bit or 64-bit or 31-bit. The operating system may put in certain limits. And then finally, you may hear different terms such as resident memory or virtual memory. Resident memory, so first let's start with virtual memory, is the total memory requested by the application. And resident memory is the amount of virtual, so it's a subset of virtual, that is at any point in time actually in physical memory, in the RAM, in the computer. On 32-bit hardware, the max theoretical native memory for each process is 4 gigabytes. This is because for a 32-bit pointer, that's the most you can address. And theoretically, on 64-bit, you can have up to 16 exabytes or 16 million terabytes. These are just theoretical numbers. And also, if you're running a 32-bit process inside of a 64-bit operating system, then that 32-bit process still has a 32-bit virtual address space. The actual native memory layout and the practical limitations depend on many other variables, including the type of processor. So, you know, whether it's Intel or AMD or IBM or whatever other processors, and not only the processor, but also the kernel, the Linux kernel that's built for that processor. So I'm not going to, it's actually very quite difficult to get all the details on all these processors. So I focused on one of the most common processors, which is x86-64 and x86-32. Things may be slightly different for Tower, Z Linux, Itanium, ARM, etc. Slide 5, please. So by default, for 32-bit, this is what the Linux native memory layout looks like on the left-hand side, the first vertical bar. What you see is that from 0 to 3 gigabytes, that's allocated for the actual user program, such as Java, and the kernel gets the other gigabyte. And on 32-bit, this is slightly different. I'm sorry, on 64-bit, if you're running a 32-bit process, you actually get most of the 4 gigabytes. The kernel just gets a little bit. There is also a huge mem kernel, which was commonly used previously on Red Hat and other distributions. This may have some overhead because of some design considerations, such as the hardware translation buffer. So I won't cover that in detail. Most customers that had used that previously have now just gone with 64-bit. Slide 6, please. Now, I mentioned before malloc and mmap. These are two common things that are worth, they're kind of very low level, but they're worth understanding. These are functions that are called by the program, such as Java or a third-party library, to get native memory from the operating system. So just because you have, let's say, 3 gigabytes of user address space, the operating system doesn't actually allocate all of that immediately because there would be no point to do that if you're not going to use it. So as the program is requesting memory, it's actually asking for blocks, chunks of memory. Malloc is kind of a standard POSIX way of asking for virtual address space, and there are different implementations of malloc. On Linux, the most common is glibc, and most malloc implementations will somehow manage free memory without giving it back to the operating system. And the idea there is to avoid actual context switches into the kernel and to make it easier to manage small chunks of memory and give it back to the application when it requires previously used memory. I'm sorry, when an application will use memory, give it back by calling free, that puts it in a pool, and then glibc or other similar implementations can just give requested memory back from that pool. This is, malloc itself is actually just built on top of the kernel break and sbreak system calls, and the way the kernel manages this part of the address space is that it has what's called the data segment or the heap segment, and this is just a contiguous area of the address space which was designed for this usage of memory. And so malloc, let's say you It doesn't have, you ask malloc for some memory, it doesn't have any in its free pool, so it'll increase, it'll call sbreak, for example, to increase the amount that the operating system provides to the address space in that area, and then it gives back that a chunk of that memory. MMAP is not as standardized. It's generally available everywhere, but it has various different options. And when you can also get a chunk of memory from the operating system using MMAP, but it's not part of this contiguous area like the heap segment is. And so fragmentation is not as much of a problem as with malloc, because there it was managing these free chunks and trying to fulfill requests from these free chunks, which can get fragmented with the used chunks, whereas MMAP is always going to the kernel and asking for a chunk of memory. And so you can still have fragmentation at the kernel level in the MMAP space, but that's less common than you would have in malloc. So when the other difference is that with MMAP, when you free an allocation that you previously got with MMAP, it's immediately returned to the operating system. It's not put in some sort of pool. There is a little bit more overhead because in most cases, an anonymous, what's called an anonymous MMAP is the way that, you would request a chunk of virtual memory, is automatically zero filled, and so there's a bit of overhead there. And it's also always page size, so there might be some memory waste. Generally, malloc is faster for small periodic and transient allocations than MMAP, and MMAP is generally used for larger allocations. Slide 7, please. This is a particular thing of note for glibc on Linux, which is the default. When in recent versions, when glibc detects that there's a lot of concurrent requests for memory through malloc, then it will break up the overall data segment into multiple virtual heaps. The idea is that, and then it assigns threads to certain heaps. The idea is that you can reduce lock contention across threads when many threads are concurrently asking for malloc data or blocks. So the way it does this is that it has various tuning options to control how many of these pools it will allocate, which are called arenas, and when it will start to allocate. And this number by default is a function of the number of whether you're on 32-bit or 64-bit, and whether you and the number of CPU cores. And this was introduced in glibc 2.11. So, for example, if you're moving from Red Hat 5 to Red Hat 6, then you will get this new behavior, and you may see some increase in virtual memory usage. So part of the reason this occurs is because the free trees of when malloc decides to give back a chunk to that was previously freed are separate. And so depending on which thread you're in, you may not have the same access to the same amount of free space that you would previously, because now the free trees are separated or split across the arenas. And in theory, and there's a sufficient evidence for this for many programs, the net performance impact of this design should be positive, because you're reducing the potential contention. There is some potential cost with the separate free trees. However, we have noticed in some customer situations that, first of all, you may see the virtual size of the process balloon, because based on a little bit of thread contention for malloc, it might create a lot of these arenas. So these arenas have some fixed size, but that's just a virtual size. That doesn't mean that it's actually that much is in resident memory in physical RAM. And so you might see, for example, if you switch to Red Hat from 5 to 6, you might see the virtual process size balloon. We have seen up to tens of gigabytes more. As long as, first of all, you don't see any impact, and second of all, on either performance, whether it's throughput or CPU usage, and as long as your resident memory stays roughly the same, then it's nothing to worry about. But if you do see some change when you migrate, and let's say you've run out of ideas for what else might have caused the change, it's worth testing to revert back to a previous behavior or just to limit the number of arenas using an environment variable called malloc arena max. Slide 8, please. On recent kernels for 32-bit, the native heap, which was what I mentioned was, I named it the heap segment before, now I'm calling it the native heap, but they're the same thing, and this is where the malloc goes. So malloc is that contiguous area that's commonly used for many native allocations. So that's growing from zero up. Sorry, it's kind of flipped, like a diagram. And at the bottom, you have the gigabyte for the kernel. Then you have the stack, which starts towards the end of the 3 gigabytes, growing down towards zero. And then at some point beyond the stack, the primordial stack, this is randomized so that it's harder to blow the stack, you have mmap and shared libraries, which grow down towards the native heap. And one other interesting thing about glibc is that when you call malloc, it actually will either request memory from the data segment or from mmap, depending on various thresholds, which can change at runtime. So usually this is the size of the request. So let's say you request 5 megabytes from malloc, it's likely that it will actually not go to the data segment, which is the native heap at the top, but actually get it from mmap at the bottom. And you can control this with various options. Slide 9, please. On 64-bit, this is the layout on the right side. It's very similar in that at the bottom of the address space at 0, which is at the top of the diagram, you have some little bit of space, then you have the actual text, which is the code of the program, such as Java. Then, again, you have the data segment, which is growing down or growing up towards the top of the address space. At the bottom, you have the kernel, which gets kind of basically half of the address space. There's a large reserve space. This is particular to the Intel and AMD 64-bit hardware processor. And then at 128 terabytes, the stack, the primordial stack, starts and grows down. And then again, at some point beyond that, you have mmap and shared libraries growing down. And, okay, well, let's just stop there. Slide 10, please. Now, previously, when in 32-bit, if you had a leak, you would just crash at some point because 4 gigabytes is not a whole lot for modern programs. And so if you had a leak, even if it was pretty small over time, at some point you would just hit the 3 gigabytes or 4 gigabytes, whatever it is, and you would crash or some other strange behavior would occur. On 64-bit, this becomes a little bit more difficult because the virtual address space is essentially unlimited. You're actually only limited by your physical memory. At some point, if you did have a leak on 64-bit, you will leak until you start to page because the kernel will continue to give memory because it's just virtual memory, but at some point, you're limited by physical memory. So let's say you have 5 gigabytes of physical memory or whatever it is, and you have a slow leak, the kernel will continue to give memory out as long as you have swap space available, and then it will actually start to swap. And this is really the worst condition because it becomes essentially a zombie, and it may not often be obvious why that occurs. Moreover, Linux may decide to, by default, kill the process and not leave much trace. And so it may be difficult to determine why it was killed. I'll cover the Linux out-of-memory killer later in the process. So the takeaway here is that it's absolutely critical, particularly for 64-bit, for everyone to monitor the native memory usage of processes at all times and to have that historical data so that if you get into this zombie situation, you can determine that this was causing not only the paging, or which process was causing the paging, etc. Slide 11, please. Starting with what I think most customers will have in Linux 2.4, there's the /proc virtual file system, which contains a maps virtual file for each process. And what you can do is you can actually print the contents of this file, and this gives you a snapshot of what are called the virtual memory areas of Linux. And this includes, as you can see at the top, Java on the right side, that's the actual executable code of the program that's running. You'll notice, as per the previous diagrams, it's quite low in the address space, the 4 and 5 zeros there. So it's starting pretty low in the address space. And then you have the heap segment, which is the second line. This is the native heap, the data segment. This is often, when you see a leak, you will see this area growing. So this is a very important thing to monitor if you believe there's a leak. And the size of this segment is the, if you subtract the second address from the first address from the second address. So in the heap segment example, you would subtract 1 fox 5, et cetera, from 1 fox 7 1, et cetera. There are various permissions on each area. You'll also see the primordial stack and other sections. Slide 12, please. In more recent versions, there's a very similar file called SMAPS. This is preferable to MAPS because it has the same exact output, but for each virtual memory area, it includes the size, so you don't have to do the calculation yourself. It also includes how much of that is actually resident in memory, the RSS. It also includes a very interesting PSS, which is the proportional set size. So if a virtual memory area is shared across processes, this file will calculate how many processes are sharing this area, and when it prints PSS, it divides the total number by the the RSS, so how much is resident, by the number of processes sharing that area. And finally, now that I've explained that those MAPS files, really the best way to look at that data is using something like PMAP, which is a command that you can either install or comes with Linux, and you would just pass again the PID, and you would get a prettier version of this data. Slide 13, please. There's also an interesting program called SMEM, which is available in most distributions, although it's optional, not installed by default. And it includes basically the same information as PMAP, but also includes the PSS, proportional set size. And finally, the /proc/pid status file includes some interesting statistics, like how much, what's the maximum, the peak virtual memory that had been requested by the process, how much is resident at that snapshot time, and other information that summarizes the virtual memory usage. Slide 14, please. Now, one thing that is very interesting on Linux is that by default, Linux has an optimistic, the glibc has an optimistic memory allocation strategy, which means that in most cases, unless you've configured otherwise, it will, and unless there are some other conditions, such as all swap being unavailable, it will return a pointer to memory, even if that memory is not really available in physical or swap. And then what happens is the kernel watches for any time that there's the actual demands of all the processes exceed what's available, and if that's true, obviously that's a limitation that has been reached, and the kernel will decide to kill one of the processes. Now, I'll cover this in detail, but this is controlled by the overcommit memory configuration, and so the default is zero, which is the heuristic overcommit, and I'll cover why you might want to change that. Slide 15, please. So how do you know if the kernel has decided to kill a process because of this? If you check var log messages, you will see kernel out of memory killed process. It also prints some other information, such as general statistics about all of the current physical memory and things like that. Now, what's interesting is that if, let's say, you have WebSphere installed and it's running and it's using half the memory, let's say, for example, and then suddenly you have some totally errant process, let's say some background process, that's not related to the activity, the core activity of the server, and let's say that it makes the request for a lot of memory. It is possible that the kernel will decide to kill WebSphere application server instead of the process that had been requesting that all that memory. There are various heuristics of how the kernel decides this and various scores that it gives each process, and those can be controlled, but just so you know that it, just because the kernel has decided to kill a particular process does not necessarily mean that this was the process at fault for eating up all the memory. One other thing, kind of more generally, the last bullet point, the free command is a useful way to understand how much of physical memory is actually free. And the key thing to look at is the minus plus buffers cache line and the second column of that, which in this case is showing 13504, 13 gigabytes, because I've passed in the dash M parameter. And what this does is because the kernel has what's called the file cache, which is an area of memory that it aggressively tries to cache file operations into so that it can increase the performance of file operations. This memory, however, can always be pushed out if the user program demands increase. And so to get an understanding of true free physical memory, you should look at the free memory minus the actual file cache and other shared buffers and things like that. And that is done by looking at the minus plus buffers cache line under the free column. Slide 16, please. This is more detail on the out-of-memory killer. I'll skip this due to time. Slide 17, please. So should you disable the OOM killer? I think this is a funny and apt analogy that was on the Linux kernel mailing list. I'll read it out because I think it's funny. An aircraft, this is somebody responding to kind of curious behavior of the out-of-memory killer. And this person said, an aircraft company discovered that it was cheaper to fly its planes with less fuel on board. Planes would be lighter and use less fuel, and money was saved. On rare occasions, however, the amount of fuel was insufficient and the plane would crash. This problem was solved by the engineers of the company by the development of a special out-of-fuel mechanism. In emergency cases, a passenger was selected and thrown out of the plane. A large body of theory was developed, and many publications were devoted to the problem of properly selecting the victim to be ejected. Should it be chosen at random or the heaviest? Now that it existed, it would be activated every now and then and eject passengers even when there was no fuel shortage. The engineers are still studying precisely how this malfunction was caused. This is one thing you'll often hear about the OOM killer is there are sometimes very mysterious cases of the killer occurring, and it's very difficult to reproduce the exact conditions under which it occurred. So I'm not making a particular recommendation here of whether you should keep it enabled or disabled, but it's very important to be aware of it and make a decision based on that data. Slide 18, please. Compressed references are very related to native memory usage. Starting with IBM Java 6, the compressed references reduce the amount of native memory used by the process by essentially fitting a 4-bit pointer into, what would normally be an 8-bit pointer into a 8 bytes to 4 bytes. And this will normally reduce the overhead of 64-bit compared to 32-bit because the actual L2 and L3 CPU caches have higher utilization rates. There are other factors, the translation buffers, et cetera. And I won't go into deep detail here, but if you're on 64-bit and your max heap is less than 25 gigs, that means you are using compressed references. And with certain versions of Java, where it places the heap, the actual Java heap, may constrict the amount of native memory that is available for the compressed references, because ultimately the compressed references can't go beyond the 4 gigabytes because they are just 4-byte pointers. Then there are some other tricks that it can use to go beyond that, such as shift arithmetic, but this is constricted by where the heap, the Java heap is. And so if you are getting strange out of memories that you can't figure out in any other way, you can actually control where the Java heap goes. And I know this might be a little bit confusing, so normally IBM support will help you through testing whether this is the case or not. You shouldn't jump too quickly to this because it may actually, by changing the preferred heap base, if it starts to shift the pointers, it may actually decrease throughput by a few percentage points. So it's worth considering whether there are alternatives. Slide 19, please. So what are some native allocations that are commonly made by the JVM? The Java heap itself is a native allocation allocated using mmap. Other native allocations include, there's a spelling mistake here, native threads and actual classes. the backing of classes. The just-in-time compiler is compiling bytecode to native code, various other things, JNI, direct byte buffers, type 2 database drivers, third-party libraries, etc. If you have a native memory leak, one of the first things you should check are what third-party libraries are being used, and native libraries, and try a test without them, because it's very common that a native library has the leak. Slide 20, please. So how do you detect that you've had a native out of memory? The most common way is that you will get a Java out of memory error, which has a detailed error code that you can see in the Java core. In this case, failed to create a thread, retval-1. And that's one example of a native out of memory. If you see detail Java lang out of memory error without the extra after that quote, then usually that's a Java out of memory. If you see some extra data like fail to create a thread, then that's commonly a native out of memory. Slide 21, please. Another piece of evidence is that if the thread details of the current thread in the Java core shows that the thread was in a native method at the top of the stack, then that is commonly caused by a lack of native memory. Slide 22, please. So how do you monitor native memory? PS is the most obvious and simplest, and this script here is actually taken from the garbage collection and memory visualizer tool. That's a free tool provided by IBM through the IBM Support Assistant, and this script is provided in the help contents, and you can use it to output the virtual size and residence size of a particular process over time with some interval into a file, and then load that into the GCMV tool, which can then graph it and show you the data in table form. Or you could look at it in manual as well. Slide 23, please. So PS, what is VSZ and RSS? Virtual size is the total amount of virtual memory that has been requested since the start of the program up to that snapshot point. Actually, could be less, but anyway, it's a snapshot of the amount that is currently requested. And that does not mean that all of that is in use. It's just the total amount requested by the process. And resident is how much of VSZ is actually resident in physical memory. And to deal with the zombie issue previously, it's very important to have some sort of historical monitoring. You could use that script that was on the previous slide. I prefer some sort of more comprehensive monitoring solution. So whether you have some third-party product that's monitoring everything, some simple built-in tools are ATOP and NMON. These are free, and they can log using crontab or just in the background. And most importantly, these in particular will log not only high-level system statistics, but also process-level statistics, which is really important. Whereas SAR is useful, but it doesn't have process-level virtual and resident memory. Slide 24, please. You can also use IBM Java Health Center, either dynamically attaching to a process or in a headless mode, and that can track virtual memory and resident memory. Slide 25, please. Starting in Java 6.2.6, which is WAS 8 or above, there is an extra section in the Java core which breaks down from a Java point of view, IBM Java point of view, the various allocations that IBM Java itself made or was requested to make. This is not the total virtual memory requested by the process. Java can't see all of the allocations. This is just for IBM Java and anything that requested IBM Java to allocate memory. This is a great way to understand if there is a leak, whether it is within IBM Java or outside IBM Java. This is probably one of the best places to start. If you just take periodic Java cores and compare the top line there, which says JRE, that's the total amount of virtual memory requested by IBM Java, and compare that to the virtual size of the process. And if the JRE is not growing, but the VSZ is growing, then most likely there is a leak outside of IBM Java in a third-party library or something like that. Or it may be fragmentation, something like that. Slide 26, please. It's just a continuation of that example, some of the information it provides. Slide 27, please. U-limits are a common cause of native out-of-memory errors. They're actually not native out-of-memory. They're nuxes, native out of X, which is caused by a limit imposed on the process. A common one is the maximum number of open files. So you can set this unlimited, or you can set it to something like 50,000. And files include actual files, like a text file or a jar file or whatever. But a socket is also a file. So if you have a lot of incoming network connections, each one of those is what's called a file descriptor, which is limited by this value. The next one is nproc, which is dash u, which is the max user processes. So these are for a particular user across processes. There's a limit imposed on how many processes that user can spawn, and a Java thread counts towards this because it's a lightweight process. And so this is a very common recent cause of issues because Red Hat 6 changed the default from a very large number to 1024 to protect against a certain type of attack. And this has now, because Java is common, it's common to use many threads in Java, and especially across a user. And so this will commonly cause out of memories, or out of X, in this case, processes. This one thing to note is that this should be configured in the 90-nproc.conf file instead of the limits.conf file, because that takes precedence. Finally, the data segment itself might be limited, or the virtual size. Those are rarely set, but certainly worth checking. And you can also echo cat the current configured limits of a running process by catting the limits file. And if you're going to be updating some of these values while you're there, make sure to update the core and file size limits to unlimited so that in case you have crashes, you can get full core dumps. Slide 28, please. These are some techniques to try to avoid or isolate the issue instead of actually analyzing it, because that's difficult. So some of these techniques will definitely have costs, so don't just apply these willy-nilly to production. The most important is the maximum heap size, because the maximum heap size is just another allocation. So any memory that is requested by the heap, because that's just going to be a very large virtual memory allocation, any memory that's used by the Java heap is not available for non-Java heap allocations, such as classes and threads, and et cetera. So if let's say you're on 32-bit and you've got a 2-gig maximum heap, since the user address space is 3 gigabytes, that means you've only got a gig for other native memory allocations. So you can try to reduce that if you can, if your application supports that. You can also reduce the number of threads, because each thread takes some space, which is controlled by the stack size. And obviously a thread itself may allocate native memory indirectly. You could try to reduce the number of classes or classlers, for example, using shared classes. In older versions, we had some issues with thread pools when min wasn't set to max. That might cause some leaks of thread locals. Make sure you have the latest version of native libraries, like Type 2 database drivers. You can also just simply, reduce the amount of throughput, the amount of work that each JVM does, and scale out, add more JVMs horizontally. Slide 29, please. Some others include, make sure you're on the latest WebSphere and Java fix packs. Sometimes there are fixes. Make sure no-class GC is not set. That's generally not recommended. Another, if you're using reflection very heavily, basically the JVM may decide at some point when a reflection class is used heavily to generate dynamically a class for that, and that can create native memory usage because of the backing of that. Whether you're using AIO and NIO, et cetera, slide 30, please. Direct byte buffers are a way for a Java program to access native blocks of native memory, which might be used to insert in optimization techniques. And one of the things that this is hitting customers more often is that, for example, with IBM's GenCon garbage collection policy, which is a generational policy, if a direct byte buffer a direct byte buffer in Java is very small, but it may hold on to a native block of memory which Java is not aware of. And so it's what's called an iceberg in that case, where there's a little piece in Java memory, in the Java heap, but a very large piece in native memory. And if, for example, that object gets put into the tenured region of the generation collector, then Java is not really aware of how much real memory that object is consuming. And so it may come to the point where the native memory becomes exhausted because there's a lot of these trash direct byte buffers in the tenured space waiting for a full collection. And so you can try to avoid this scenario by using -d sun NIO max direct memory size, which says when that number of bytes has been allocated by direct byte buffers, call system.gc to force any direct byte buffers that are in the tenured space that are trashed to be cleaned up and any native memory that they have. Direct byte buffers use phantom references, which are similar to finalizers, and that's why these trash direct byte buffers can be left around. You can also use the IBM extensions for memory analyzer if you get a system dump to list all the direct byte buffers and how much native memory they contain. And before Java 7, it was a design choice in Java that every direct byte buffer request was rounded to the page size. And so if you request a direct byte buffer of 1 byte, it would actually round up to whatever, it's 4K or 1 meg, and so it could be a tremendous waste of space. And that will also be shown in the extensions for memory analyzer. Slide 31, please. Some other analysis. In previous versions before Java 6.2.6, WAS 8, Java cores also had some native memory information. It was more general and didn't include everything. So, but you can use this in previous versions to summarize some of the IBM Java's memory usage. Also, if you're leaking class loaders, that often can cause native amount of memory is because the class loaders can't be garbage collected, and so they hold native memory. So, for example, if you see native leaks after restarting the application many times and running GCs, and it's still not clearing up native memory, it could be caused by a class loader leak. There are some tools that can help you determine what's causing the leak. Slide 32, please. This is a way to determine if the leak is within IBM Java, how to tell where it is, but this is actually more applicable to older versions. I would suggest you just using the latest Java core data. Slide 33, please. If you suspect it might be a third-party JNI library, you can do some rough checks with -x check JNI all, which can print some warnings. Slide 34, please. You could do some eye-catcher hunting. This is pretty advanced analysis, and it's essentially looking for eye-catchers that are at the top of native memory allocations, but this has to be part of the application design. The JVM itself does have eye-catchers for every allocation, so you could, but you wouldn't need to do that because the Java core does that for you. But if a third-party library has eye-catchers, you can look for those. Slide 35, please. So often, if you have to go past Java cores and you want to look inside the raw memory, you'll need a system dump. To do that, you should get a core dump using, let's say, G core or something else. Then you J-extract it to make sure that you get all the libraries. And then you can, for example, look at direct byte buffers. Slide 36, please. One interesting thing about Linux core files is they're ELF structured files, which is similar to an executable file. And when IBM Java creates the system dump, whether it's requested by the configuration or it catches a signal that's a crash, it will, since the Linux kernel doesn't provide an API to produce a core dump, the way IBM Java creates a core dump is it forks itself and then kills that child. And this is fine because the memory is copy on write, and so it should not increase your physical memory usage or anything like that. It may run into issues if your virtual memory has reached its limit. The only other issue is that GDB will only see the forked thread in the child. It won't see all the threads in the parent. However, if you use one of the Java tools to look at the dump, it will be able to reconstruct all the threads. Slide 37, please. here are some ways to get a system dump. You can use WSAdmin, using JSP, Health Center, other ways. Java Surgery is one way to dynamically connect to a JVM and call the API. That's in the second bullet. And also you can say to switch to an out-of-memory, to switch to system dumps on out-of-memory instead of PhDs. This is actually the default starting in WAS 802. It, when there's an out-of-memory error, it does what it used to do, which is take a PhD, heap dump, Java Core, and Snap file, but it will also create a system dump on the first out-of-memory. However, you have to make sure that your U-limits are set up so that it's not truncated. Slide 38, please. System dumps are larger because they are essentially a dump of the virtual address space. So they are generally in the same magnitude as PhD heap dumps, but they will usually be slower. If you have enough free physical memory and your file cache is big enough, that's the best way to improve performance of system dumps because essentially the kernel will write the core dump to RAM and then asynchronously write it to the file. You can control some of the file cache settings with the swappiness parameter. Slide 39, please. There are some options in using the core dump filter, which controls what the kernel will actually dump to the file. And you can increase this, although I've found that it's not doesn't change the results significantly. Slide 40, please. You can control the name of the file if the file produced is not produced by IBM Java, name of the core file. Slide 41, please. If you're going to use GCore, which is part of GDB, to get a system dump instead of using the IBM Java system dump mechanism, that's fine. Just make sure to get some extra data, such as the proc maps and other information. This is an example script that gets that information. Slide 42, please. The GDB is the way to analyze a core dump, and I won't go into much detail here, but basically once you have the JX track, you unzip it, and you will require the debug info packages. These include the symbols for the libraries, and they will have to match the libraries that were running. So if the dump is given to you from some system, you have to get the matching debug info libraries from that system. So usually it's easier just to run GDB on the same machine if you can. Slide 43, please. This is an example of how to load GDB with libraries from a zip file. But again, you need to point to the debug info things. And here are some common commands listing the backtrace of the current thread. I'll list all the threads and list backtraces for all the threads. Slide 44, please. Some other commands to do some more advanced analysis. Slide 45, please. This is a technique to understand how much has been malloced in glibc. Slide 46, please. So this is a well-known article on Linux native memory problem determination, and as this points out, currently debugging native memory leaks on Linux with freely available tools is more challenging than other operating systems such as Windows, whereas on Windows you have UMDH and other operating systems similar tools. On Linux, you need to do some traditional debugging. Slide 47, please. Valgrind is one way to determine a leak. Valgrind, unfortunately, virtualizes the memory allocation system, and so it can have a dramatic performance impact, up to 10 to 20, 30x. So this is normal. You can't really run this in production unless you have some tiny workload. But even, for example, if you wanted to run it on WebSphere, even just starting WebSphere is going to take a really long time. Slide 48, please. Linux Native Tracker is a tool provided by IBM Java support. And in the worst case, you can ask for this. However, and it's very similar to some of the other tools on operating systems, where it will track malloc that don't have freeze in the stacks. However, it's quite difficult to get you have to get a custom build, and it's difficult to run and install, so it's certainly an option. Slide 49, please. Mtrace is the built-in tracker in glibc. However, it does not track stack traces, and it also has a global lock anytime it's called, so it can dramatically impact performance. Slide 50, please. Strace will trace system calls, which would be things like mmap or break, And so you can dynamically test your process and see if S-break is being called or if MMAP is being called. It doesn't give you much, but it will tell you that it is being called. Slide 58, please. L-trace is similar to S-trace, but it traces user library calls, such as glibc. So in this case, you can track malloc and free, again, if it's being called. Slide 52. Well, also, it will give you the address. So you could, for example, take a dump of the process and then go look at that address and see if you can figure out what type of memory is being allocated. 52, please. System tap is very similar to dtrace on Solaris. It's a debugging tool that hooks into the kernel, and it does require root privilege and debug info packages, but this, I think, is a very good way that I haven't had much time to explore, but I think it's worth exploring more to essentially do what some of the other operating systems do by tracking mallocs and frees and the stack traces. Slide 53, please. So that's it. In conclusion, I know that was a lot to cover. I know we don't have much time left, but I hope to hear some of your questions. To summarize, native memory issues are very difficult. They tend to be more difficult on Linux. It's very important that paging, system paging and memory usage, as well as process, resident, and virtual memory usage are tracked historically over time. I would recommend, if you are worried about native memory, whether it's a leak or whatever, the best place to start, especially with IBM Java 66, WAS 8, is with periodic Java cores to watch not only how much memory the JVM is allocating versus the virtual size of the process, but also within the IBM JVM, you can see, are class loaders leaking, how many threads do you have, and a lot more information that is directly related to native memory. If the concern is outside of IBM Java, which you can determine through the Java core, then the best place to start is with SMAPs, which helps you determine where the leak is, and it's usually going to be in the heap segment, which means it's something outside IBM Java calling malloc. Some other key things to watch for, again, whatever the Java heap takes is not available for other native memory. The U limits are very important. Some options like XNO class GC, very large thread size, XSS, whether there's a third-party library, JVMTI agent using XRun or Java agent, agent lib, the shared class size, XSCMX, with 64-bit compressed references, watch out for where the heap goes and how it limits the native memory space. Make sure to, again, monitor to get the latest versions of third-party native libraries, and watch with generational garbage collectors, watch for these iceberg objects. And then I recommend, if all else fails, first try SystemTap or Valgrind if you can in a test environment. If all that fails and all the other techniques covered here aren't getting you anywhere, then you can consider opening a PMR and asking for the Linux native tracker. Slide 54, please. I just want to thank Neil Mason and Andrew Hall for helping me on this presentation and many others that provided feedback. Slide 55, please. Slide 56, please. This is how to debug kernel memory, just for those curious. Slide 57, please. This is details about how thread stacks are allocated, where they're allocated. They're essentially MMAPs. Slide 58, please. And finally, to learn more about Webster Technical Exchanges and other resources, you can visit the links on this page. And I'll turn it over to you, David.
Thank you, Kevin, for a great presentation. At this time, we would like to open the lines for questions.
There are no questions at this time.
Thank you. We do have a few questions in the group chat, and while most of them have been answered by Kevin, it would probably be worthwhile to repeat them on the phone. The first question is, on a 32-bit process, what are the programs included on the 3-gigabyte space only Java, and what is the 1-gigabyte space used for?
Right, so I think the answer there is that each process has its own virtual address space, and so that 3-gigabyte space per process is per process, not across processes. The 1-gigabyte space for the kernel is across processes. And David,
okay.
Did you want me to just go through all the other questions and answers?
Sure, if you don't mind.
Sure. The next question was, what is an iCatcher? An iCatcher is essentially just an old trick. Every time you ask for memory, you put in some combination of hexadecimal values that are unlikely to randomly occur in memory. And so if you're paging through the raw memory of the hex dump of a core dump, and you notice these eye catchers, they catch your eye. And so if you have a lot of them, that may be the cause of the leak. The next question was, why is the default thread pool size min equals max in WAS 7? And primarily that was updated just because in modern servers, there's the costs of reducing the threads when they're idle outweighs any much of the benefits. Next question was, is there a similar presentation for Windows? Or for AIX? And the answer is yes. There is another one of these. If you just search Webster Technical Exchanges for AIX and Windows, you'll find a very similar presentation covering all the operating system-specific tools. And I hope one day to finish off the other operating systems, the OS and Solaris and HP and others. Next question was, should I conclude that Malloc Arena Max will prevent the zombies caused by leaks? And that's possible, but that's not where I would start because it's unlikely that that would cause so much fragmentation that it would cause your RAM to be exhausted, although it's possible. Next one was, what is the URL of the document? I'm not sure if you mean this presentation, but it's, or the AX presentation, but if you just search Webster Technical Exchange, you should be able to find it. How can memory leaks cause CPU leaks? So most commonly it would just be because of paging. So you'll see, if you start to page, then you'll see a lot of CPU usage in kernel time or system time. And there are other ways, probably unlikely to have a huge CPU leak. But for example, if there's a lot of lock contention on Malloc because of threads are leaking and constantly allocating memory that they shouldn't be, that could cause some extra CPU usage. And last question is, how to identify a list of child processes for parent JVM process? So if you just use PS, then that will, you'll find the parent, and then you can search for the parent process ID. And then the final point was to clarify a previous question on CPU spikes. And yeah, I think it's not likely, unless you start to page. If you start to page, you probably will see CPU spikes. Otherwise, if you just have a leak that's not causing paging, it's probably unlikely to cause massive spikes. Although, again, it might cause some spikes. But the best way there would be simply to determine whether that's causing the CPU spikes is just to have a graph of VSD or RSS plotted on the same graph as CPU. And if those are correlated, then that's probably the reason. Next question, if I have, say, 10 servers in one WebSphere node, and each of them have 2 gigabyte maximum Java heap, would each server have separate native memory? Yes. So each Java heap is unique to the process. However, some of the other native, because the 2 gigabyte in that example maximum heap is just one of the native memory allocations, there will be many others that the process makes, and some of those may be shared across Webster application servers on that same node. First of all, the actual libraries themselves will by default be shared. A second, you might have the shared class cache and other similar things. I don't see description in detail for child processes. So if you just use the man PS page, you should see a column called PPID, which is the parent process ID. And so if you just do a PS on all Java processes, you'll be able to match the process to the parent. What is the best tool for memory leaks? I'm not sure if the person means, I think this might have been sent just to me, so others may not see the question. The best tool depends if you mean Java or native. I'm assuming native memory leak. And I'd say try to avoid the tools until you run out of other options. I'd say first just start with Java cores and the various other ideas I covered on the conclusion page. And I don't see any other questions, so thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Kevin. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Kevin, for presenting today.
Thanks, David. Thanks, everyone.